a thousand times too often. Rorn used his scope to check over the rim of the foxhole. Somewhere out there the Shriven were using some heavy weapon to support their infantry. The thick and explosive fire was cutting a wedge out of the ghosts as they advanced. Neff was fiddling with his weapon, and Rorn glanced down at him.
"What's the matter, Trooper?" he asked.
"There's mud in my firing mechanism, sir. I can't free it."
Fagor snatched the lasgun from the younger man, ejected the magazine, and slung back the oiled cover of the ignition chamber so that it was open and the focus rings exposed. Fagor spat into the open chamber and then slammed it shut with a clack. Then he shook it vigorously and jammed the energy magazine back into its slot. Neff watched as Fagor swung round again and lifted the gun above his head, firing it wholesale into the smoke beyond the foxhole. Fagor tossed the weapon back to the trooper.
"See, it's working now."
Neff clutched the returned weapon and wiggled up to the lip of the hole.
"We'll be dead before we go another meter,"
Lonergan said from below them.
"For feth's sake," Trooper Vahl spat, "we'll just get him ducking again."
He unhooked a clutch of grenades from his webbing and tossed them out to the other soldiers, sharing them like a schoolboy shares stolen fruit. A click of the thumb primed each weapon, and Rorn smiled to his men as he prepared to heave his into the air.
"Vahl's assessment is correct," Rorn said. "Let's blind them."
They hefted the bombs into the sky. They were frag grenades, designed to deafen, blind, and pepper those in range with needles of shrapnel. There was the multiple crump of detonation.
"That's got them ducking, at least,"
Kafran said, then realized that the others were already scrambling up out of the foxhole to charge. He followed, quickly. Screaming, the ghosts charged over a short stretch of grey ooze and then slithered down into a revetment, screened from them by the smoke. The blackened impacts of the grenades were all around them, as were the twisted bodies of several of their dead foe. Rorn slammed onto his feet at the bottom of the slide and looked around. For the first time in 6 months on Fortis Binary, he saw the enemy face to face. The Shriven, the ground forces of the enemy he had been sent here to fight. They were surprisingly human, but twisted and malformed. They wore combat armor, cleverly adapted from the worksuits they had used in the forges of the planet, the protective masks and gauntlets actually woven into their wasted, pallid flesh. Rorn tried not to linger on the dead. It made him think too much about those legions he had still to kill. In the smoke, he found two more of the Shriven, crippled by the grenade blasts. He finished them quickly. He found Kafran close behind him. The young trooper was shocked by what he saw.
"They have lasguns," Kafran said, aghast, "and body armor."
Beside him, Neff turned one of the corpses over with his toe.
"And look, they have grenades and munitions."
Neff and Kafran looked at the major.
Rorn shrugged. "So they're tough bastards. What did you expect? They've held the Imperium off for 6 months.
Lonergan, Vahl, and Fagor hurried along to join them. Rorn waved them along further into the enemy dugout. The space widened in front of them, and they saw the metal-beamed stone barns of an industrial silo. Rorn quickly gestured them into cover. Almost at once, lasfire started to sear down the trench towards them. Vahl was hit, and his shoulder vanished in a puff of red mist. He went down hard on his backside, and then flopped over, clutching with the one arm that would still work. The pain was so momentous, he couldn't even scream.
"Feth!" spat Rorn. "See to him, Neff!"
Neff was the squad medic. He pulled open his thigh pouch of field dressings as Fagor and Kafran tried to drag the whimpering Vahl into cover. Gleaming lines of lasfire stitched the trench line and tried to pin them all. Neff quickly bound Vahl's ghastly injury.
"We'll have to get him back, sir,"
he shouted down the grey channel to Rorn. Rorn was pushing himself into the cover of the defile, the grey ooze matting his hair as the lasbursts burned the air around him.
"Not now," he said.
6. Ibram Gaunt leapt down into the trench and broke the neck of the first Shriven he met with his descending boots. The chainsword screamed in his fist, and as he reached the duckboards of the enemy emplacement, he swung it left and right to cut two more apart in drizzles of blood. Another charged him, a great curved blade in his hand. Gaunt raised his bolt pistol and blew the masked head into vapor. This was the thickest fighting Gaunt and his men had encountered on Fortis, caught in the frenzied narrows of the enemy trenches, sweeping this way and that to meet the incessant advance of the Shriven. Pinned behind the Commissar, Bryn Milo fired his own weapon, a compact automatic handgun that the Commissar had given him some months before. He killed one, a bullet between the eyes, then another, winging him first, and then putting a bullet into his upturned chin as he flailed backwards. Milo shivered. This was the horror of war that he had always dreamt of, yet never wished to see. Passionate men caught against each other in a dugout hole 3 meters wide and 6 deep. The Shriven were monsters, almost elephantine, with the long, nozzled gas masks sewn into the flesh of their faces. Their body armor was a dull industrial green and rubberized. They had taken the protective garb of their workspace and made it their battle dress, daubing everything with eye-aching symbols. Slammed against the trench wall by a falling body, Milo looked down at the corpses which gathered around them. He saw, for the first time, in detail, the nature of his foe. The twisted, corrupted human forms of the Chaos Host. Incised with twisted runes and sigils painted on the dull green rubber of their armor or carved into their raw flesh. One of the Shriven ploughed in past Gaunt's shrieking sword and dove at Milo. The boy dropped, and the cultist smashed into the trench wall. Scrabbling in the muddy wetness of the trench bed, Milo retrieved one of the lasguns that had fallen from the dying grasp of one of Gaunt's previous victims. The Shriven was on him as he hefted the weapon up and fired, point blank. The flaming round punched through his opponent's torso, and the dead cultist fell across him, forcing him down by sheer weight into the sucking ooze of the trench floor. Foul water surged into his mouth, and mud and blood. A second later, he was heaved, coughing, to his feet by Trooper Bragg, the most massive of the men of Tanith, who was somehow always there to watch over him.
"Get down,"
Bragg said, as he hoisted a rocket launcher onto his shoulder. Milo knelt and covered his ears, tight. Hopefully muttering the litany of true striking to himself, Bragg fired his huge weapon off down the companionway of the trench. A fountain of mud and other unnameable things were blown into fragments. He often missed what he was aiming at, but under these conditions, that wasn't an option. To their right, Gaunt was scything his way into the close-packed enemy. He began to laugh, coated with the rain of blood that he was loosing with his shrieking chainsword. Every now and then, he would fire his pistol and explode another of the Shriven. He was filled with fury. The signal from Lord General Drevere had been draconian and cruel. Gaunt would have wanted to take the enemy trenches if he could, but to be ordered to do so with no other option except death was, in his opinion, the decision of a flawed, brutal mind. He'd never liked Drevere, not at any time since their first meeting 20 years before, when Drevere had still been an ambitious armor colonel, back on Derendara, back with Oktar and the Hyakans. Gaunt had kept the nature of the orders from his men. Unlike Drevere, he understood the mechanisms of morale and inspiration. Now they were taking the damned trenches, almost in spite of Drevere's orders rather than because of them. His laughter was the laughter of fury and resentment, and pride in his men for doing the impossible, regardless. Nearby, Milo stumbled to his feet, holding the lasgun. "We're there," Gaunt thought. "We've broken them." 10 meters down the line, Sergeant Blaine leapt in with his platoon and sealed the event, blasting left and right with his lasgun as his men charged, bayonets first. There was a frenzy of lasfire and a flash of silver Tanith blades. Milo was still holding the lasgun when Gaunt snatched it from him and threw it down onto the duckboards.
"Do you think you're a soldier, boy?"
"Yes, sir."
"Really?"
"You know I am."
Gaunt looked down at the 16-year-old boy and smiled sadly.
"Maybe you are. But for now, play up. Play a tune that will sing us to glory."
Milo pulled his Tanith pipes from his pack and breathed into the chanter. For a moment, it screamed like a dying man. Then he began playing. It was Waltrab's Wild, an old tune that had always inspired the men in the taverns of Tanith to drink and cheer and make merry. Sergeant Blaine heard the tune, and with a grimace, he laid into the enemy. By his side, his adjutant, Vox Officer Simba, started to sing along as he blasted with his lasgun. Trooper Bragg simply chuckled and loaded another rocket into the huge launcher that he carried. A moment later, another section of trench dissolved in a deluge of fire. Trooper Caffran heard the music, a distant plaintive wail across the battlefield. It cheered him for a moment as he moved with the men under Major Rawn's direction up over the bodies of the Shriven, side by side with Neff, Lonergan, Larkin, and the rest. Even now, poor Val was being stretchered back to their lines, screaming as the drugs wore off. That was the moment the bombardment started. Cafran found himself flying, lifted by a wall of air issued from a bomb blast that created a crater 12 meters wide. A huge slew of mud was thrown up in the sky with him. He landed hard, broken, and his mind frayed. He lay for a while in the mud, strangely peaceful. As far as he knew, Neff, Major Rawn, Fagor, Larkin, Lonergan, all the rest were dead and vaporized. As shells continued to fall, Cafran sank his head into the slime and silently begged for release from his nightmare. A long way off, Lord High Militant General Drevere heard the vast emplacements of the Shriven artillery begin their onslaught. He realized that it would not be today after all. Sighing angrily, he poured himself another cup from the freshly refilled samovar. 7. Colonel Corbeck had 3 platoons with him and moved them forward into the traversed network of the enemy trenches. The bombardment had been howling over their heads for 2 hours now, obliterating the front edge of the Shriven emplacements and annihilating all those of the guard who had not made it into the comparative cover of enemy positions. The tunnels and channels they moved through were empty and abandoned. Clearly, the Shriven had pulled out as the bombardment began. The trenches were well made and engineered, but at every turn or bend there was a blasphemous shrine to the dark powers that the enemy worshipped. Corbeck had Trooper Skulain turn his flamer on each shrine they found and burn it away before any of his men could fully appreciate the grim nature of the offerings laid before it. By Corral's estimation, after consulting the tightly scrolled fiber-light charts, they were advancing into support trenches behind the Shriven main line. Corbeck felt cut off, not just by the savage bombardment that shook their very bones every other second, and he fervently prayed no shell would fall short into the midst of them, but more, he felt cut off from the rest of the regiment. The electromagnetic aftershock of the ceaseless barrage was scrambling their communications, both the micro-bead intercoms that all the officers wore and the long-range voxcaster radio sets. No orders were getting through, no urgings to regroup, to rendezvous with other units, to press forward for an objective, or even to retreat. In such circumstances, the rulebook of Imperial Guard warfare was clear. If in doubt, move forward. Corbeck sent scouts ahead, men he knew were fast and able, Baru, Colmar, and Scout Sergeant McColl. They pulled their Tanith stealth cloaks around them and slipped away into the dusty darkness. Walls of smoke and powder were drifting back over the trench lines, and visibility was dropping. Sergeant Blaine gestured silently up at the billowing smoke banks that were descending. Corbeck knew his intent, and knew that he didn't wish to voice it for fear of spooking the unit. The Shriven had no qualms about the use of poison agents, foul airborne gases that would boil the blood and fester the lungs. Corbeck pulled out a whistle and blew 3 short blasts. The men behind him put guns at ease and pulled respirators from their webbing. Colonel Corbeck buckled his own respirator mask around his face. He hated the loss of visibility, the claustrophobia of the thick-lensed gas hoods, the shortness of breath that the tight rubber mouthpiece provoked. But poison clouds were not the half of it. The sea of mud that the bombardment was agitating and casting up into the wind as vapor droplets was full of other venoms. The airborne spores of disease incubated in the decaying bodies out there in the dead zone. Typhus, gangrene, livestock anthrax bred in the corrupting husks of pack animals and cavalry steeds, and the vicious mycotoxins that hungrily devoured all organic matter, transforming it into a black, insidious mold. As first officer to the Tanith First, Corbeck had been privy to the dispatches circulated from the general staff. He knew that nearly 80% of the fatalities amongst the Imperial Guards since the invasion began had been down to gas, disease, and secondary infection. A Shriven soldier could face you point-blank with a charged lasgun, and still your chances of survival would be better than if you took a stroll in no man's land. Muffled and blinkered by the mask, Corbeck edged his unit on. They reached a bifurcation in the support trenches, and Korbeck called up Sergeant Grell, officer of the 5th Platoon, instructing him to take 3 fire teams to the left and cleanse whatever they found. The men moved off, and Korbeck became aware of his increasing frustration. Nothing had come back from the scouts. He was moving as blind as he had been before he sent them out. Advancing now at double time, the colonel led his remaining 100 or so men along a wide communications trench. 2 of his sharper-eyed vanguard moved in front, using magnetically sensitive wands attached to heavy backpacks to sweep for explosives and booby traps. It seemed that the Shriven had pulled back too rapidly to leave any surprises, but every few meters the column stopped as one of the sweepers found something hot. A tin cup, a piece of armor, a canteen tray. Sometimes it was a strange idol made of smelt ore from the forge furnaces that the corrupted workers had carved into some bestial form. Korbeck personally put his las pistol to each one and blew it into fragments. The 3rd time he did this, the wretched thing he was destroying blew up in sharp fragments as his round tore it open along some fault. Trooper Drayle, cowering a few paces away, was hit in the collarbone by a shard, which dug into the flesh. He winced and sat back in the mud, hard. Sergeant Corral called up the medic, who put on a field dressing. Korbeck cursed his own stupidity. He was so anxious to erase any trace of the Shriven cult, he had hurt one of his own.
"That's nothing, sir," Drayle said through his gas mask as Korbeck helped him to his feet. "At Voltus Watergate, I took a bayonet in the thigh. And back home on Tanith, he got a broken bottle end in his cheek in a bar fight," laughed Trooper Cull behind them. "He's had worse."
The men around them laughed, ugly, sucking sounds through their respirators. Korbeck nodded to show he was in tune with them. Drayle was a handsome, popular soldier whose songs and good humor kept his platoon in decent spirits. Korbeck also knew that Drayle's roguish exploits were a matter of regimental legend.
"My mistake, Drayle," Korbeck said. "I owe you a drink."
"At the very least, Colonel," Drayle said, and deftly armed his las gun to show he was ready to continue. 8. They moved on. They reached a section of trench where a monumental shell had fallen short and blown the thin cavity open in a huge crater wound nearly 30 meters across. Already, brackish groundwater was welling up in its bowl. With only the sweepers ahead of him, Korbeck waded in first to lead them across into the cover where the trench recommenced. The water came up to his mid-thigh and was acidic. He could feel it burning the flesh of his legs through his fatigues, and there was a faint swirl of mist around the cloth of his uniform as the fabric began to burn. He ordered the men behind him back and scrambled up on the far side to join the sweepers. The 3 of them looked down at their legs, horrified by the way the water had already begun to eat into the tunic cloth. Korbeck felt lesions forming on his thighs and shins. He turned back to Sergeant Corral at the head of the column across the crater.
"Move the men up and round," he cried, "and bring the medic over in the first party."
Afraid by the exposure of moving around the lip of the crater against the sky, the men traversed quickly and timidly. Korbeck had Corral regroup them on the far side in fire team lines along each side of the trench. The medic came to him and the sweepers and sprayed their legs with antiseptic mist from a flask. The pain eased, and the fabric was damped so that it no longer smoldered. Korbeck was picking up his gun when Sergeant Grell called to him. He moved forward down the lines of waiting men and saw what Grell had found. It was Kolmar, one of the scouts he had sent forward. He was dead, hanging pendulously from the trench wall on a great rusty iron spike which impaled his chest. It was the sort of spike that the workers of the forge world would have used to wedge and manipulate the hoppers of molten ore in the Adeptus Mechanicus furnace works. His hands and feet were missing. Korbeck gazed at him for a minute and then looked away. Though they had met no serious resistance, it was sickeningly clear that they weren't alone in these trenches. Whatever the number of the Shriven still here, be it stragglers left behind or guerrilla units deliberately set to thwart them, a malicious presence was shadowing them in the gullies and channels of the support trenches. Korbeck took hold of the spike and pulled Kolmar down. He took out the ground sheet from his own bedroll and rolled the pitiful corpse in it so that no one would see it. He could not bring himself to incinerate the soldier, as he had done with the shrines.
"Move on,"
he instructed, and Grell led the men forward behind the sweepers. Korbeck suddenly stopped dead, as if an insect had stung him. There was a rasping in his ear. He realized it was his microbead link. He registered an overwhelming sense of relief that the radio link should be live at all, even as he realized it was a short-range broadcast from McCull, sergeant of the scouting unit.
"Can you hear it, sir?"
came McCull's voice.
"Faith, hear what?"
Corbeck asked. All he could hear was the ceaseless thunder of the enemy guns and the shaking tremors of the falling shells.
"Drums,"
Scout Sergeant McCull said.
"I can hear drums."
9. Bryn Milo heard the drums before Gaunt did. Gaunt valued his musician's almost preternaturally sharp senses, but they sometimes disturbed him nonetheless. The insight reminded him of someone. The girl, perhaps, years ago. The one with the sight. The one who had haunted his dreams for so many years afterwards.
"Drums,"
the boy hissed. And a moment later, Gaunt caught the sound too. They were moving through the silos and shelled-out structures of the rising industrial manufactories just behind the shriven lines, sooty shells of melted stone, rusted metal girderwork, and fractured ceramite. Gargoyles, built to protect the buildings against contamination, had been defaced or toppled completely. Gaunt was exceptionally cautious. The action of the day had played out unexpectedly. They had advanced far further than he had anticipated from the starting point of a simple repulse of an enemy attack, thanks both to good fortune and Revere's harsh directive. Reaching the front of the enemy lines, they had found them generally abandoned after the initial fighting, as if the majority of the Shriven had withdrawn in haste. Though a curtain of enemy bombardment cut off their lines of retreat, Gaunt felt that the Shriven had made a great mistake and pulled back too far in their urgency to avoid both the guard attack and their own answering artillery. Either that or they were planning something. Gaunt didn't like that notion much. He had 230 men with him in a long spearhead column, but he knew that if the Shriven counterattacked now, he might as well be on his own. As they progressed, they swept each blackened factory bunker, storehouse, and forge tower for signs of the enemy, moving beneath flapping, torn banners, crunching broken stained glass underfoot. Machinery had been stripped out and removed, or simply vandalized. There was nothing whole left here, apart from the chaos shrines, which the Shriven had erected at regular intervals. Like Colonel Corbeck, the Commissar had a flamer brought up to expunge any trace of these outrages. However, ironically, he was moving in exactly the opposite direction along the trench lines to Corbeck's advance. Communication was lost, and the breakthrough elements of the Tanith First and Only were wandering blind and undirected through what was by any estimation enemy territory. The sound of the drums rolled in. Gaunt called up his voxcaster operator, Trooper Raflan, and tersely barked into the speech horn of the heavy backpack set, demanding to know if there was anyone out there. The drums rolled. There was a return across the radio link, an incomprehensible squawk of garbled words. At first, Gaunt thought the transmission was scrambled, but then he realized that it was another language. He repeated his demand, and after a long, painful silence, a coherent message returned to him in clipped, low Gothic.
"This is Colonel Zoran of the Vitrian Dragoons. We are moving in to support you. Hold your fire."
Gaunt acknowledged, and then spread his men across the silo concourse in cover, watching and waiting. Ahead of them, something flashed in the dull light, and then Gaunt saw soldiers moving down towards them. They didn't see the ghosts until the very last minute. With their tenacious ability to hide in anything and their obscuring cloaks, Gaunt's ghosts were masters of stealth camouflage. The dragoons approached in a long and carefully arranged formation of at least 300 men. Gaunt could see that they were well-drilled, slim, but powerful men in some kind of chain armor that was strangely sheened and which caught the light like unpolished metal. Gaunt shrugged off the Tanith stealth cloak that had been a habitual addition to his garb since he joined the First and Only, and moved out of concealment, signaling them openly as he rose to his feet from cover. He advanced to meet the commanding officer. Close to, the Vitrians were impressive soldiers. Their unusual body armor was made from a toothed metallic mail which covered them in form-fitting sections. It glinted like obsidian. Their helmets were full face and grim with narrow eye slits, glazed with dark glass. Their weapons were polished and clean.
"Commissar Gaunt of the Tanith First and Only,"
Gaunt said as he saluted a greeting.
"Zoran of the Vitrian Dragoons,"
came the reply.
Good to see that there are some of you left out here. We feared we were being called in to support a regiment already slaughtered.
The drums? Are they yours? Zorin slid back the visor of his helmet to reveal a handsome, dark-skinned face. He caught Gaunt with a quizzical stare.
They are not. We were just wondering what in the name of the Emperor it was ourselves.
Gaunt looked away into the smoke and the fractured buildings around them. The noise had grown. Now it sounded like hundreds of drums. Thousands, from all around. For each drum, a drummer. They were surrounded, and completely outnumbered. 10. Kafran dragged himself across the mud and slid into a crater. Around him the bombardment showed no signs of easing. He had lost his lasgun and most of his kit, but he still had his silver knife and an auto-pistol that had come his way as a trophy at some time or other. Wriggling to the lip of the crater, he caught sight of figures far away, soldiers who seemed to be dressed in glass. There was a full unit of them, caught in the crossfire of the serial bombardment. They were being slaughtered. Shells fell close again, and Kafran slid down to cover his head with his arms. This was hell, and there was no way out of it. Curse this, in the name of Feth. He looked up and grabbed his pistol as something fell into the shell hole next to him. It was one of the glass-clad soldiers he had seen from a distance, presumably one who had fled in search of cover. The man held up his hands to avoid Kafran's potential wrath.
"Guard, I'm guard, like you,"
the man said hastily, pulling off his dark-lensed full-face helmet to reveal an attractive face with skin that was almost as dark and glossy as polished ebonwood.
"Trooper Zogat of the Vitrian Regiment, we were called in to support you, and half our number were in the open when the artillery cranked up."
"My sympathies,"
Trooper Kafran said humorlessly, holstering his pistol. He held out a pale hand to shake and was aware of the way the man in the articulated metallic armor regarded the blue dragon tattoo over his right eye with disdain.
"Trooper Kafran, Tanith first," he said.
After a moment, the Vitrian shook his hand. A shell fell close and showered them in mud. Getting up from their knees, they turned and looked out at the apocalyptic vista all around.
"Well, friend," Kafran said, "I think we're here for the duration."
11. To the west, the Jantine patricians moved in under the command of Colonel Flens. They rode on Chimera personnel carriers that lurched and reeled across the slick and miry landscape. The patricians were noble soldiers, tall men in deep purple uniforms dressed with chrome. Flens had been honored when, 6 years before, he had become their commanding officer. They were haughty and resolute, and had won for him a great deal of praise. They had a regimental history that dated back 15 generations to their first founding in the castellated garrisons of Jant Normalidus Prime, generations of notable triumphs and associations with illustrious generals and campaigns. There was just the one blemish on their honor roll. Just the one. And it nagged at Flens day and night. He would rectify that, here on Fortis Binary. He took his scope and looked at the battlefield ahead. He had two columns of vehicles with upwards of 10,000 men scissoring in to cut into the flank of the Shriven as the Tanith and the Vitrians drove them back. Both those regiments were fully deployed into the Shriven lines. But Flens had not counted on this bombardment from the Shriven artillery in the hills. 2 kilometers ahead, the ground was volcanic with the pounding of the macro shells and a drizzle of mud fogged back to splatter their vehicles. There was no way of going round, and Flens didn't even wish to consider the chances of driving his column through the barrage. Lord General Drevere believed in acceptable losses and had demonstrated this practicality on a fair few number of occasions without compunction, but Flens wasn't about to commit suicide. His scar twitched. He cursed. For all his maneuvering with Drevere, this wasn't the way it was meant to go. He had been cheated of his victory.
"Pull back,"
he ordered into the Vox handset, and felt the gears of his vehicle grind into reverse as the carrier pulled around. His second officer, a big, older man called Brochus, glared at him under the low brim of his helmet.
"We are to pull out, Colonel?"
he asked, as if obliteration by artillery shell was something he craved.
"Shut up,"
spat Flens, and repeated the order into the Vox caster.
"What about Gaunt?"
Brochus asked.
"What do you think?"
Flens sneered. gesturing out of the Chimera's vision slit at the inferno that raged along the deadland.
We may not get glory today, but at least we can content ourselves in the knowledge that that bastard is dead.
Brockus nodded, and a slow smile of consolation spread across his grizzled features. None of the veterans had forgotten KED 1173. The patrician armored convoy snaked back on itself and thundered home towards friendly lines before the shriven emplacements could range them. Victory would have to wait a while longer. The Tanith First and Only and the Vitrian support regiments were on their own, if there were indeed any of them left alive. A memory. Giletus Decimus, 18 years earlier. Octar died slowly. It took 8 days. The commander had once joked, on Darendara, or was it Folion? Gorn forgot. But he remembered the joke. It won't be war that slays me. It'll be these damn victory celebrations. They had been in a smoke-filled hall, surrounded by cheering citizens and waving banners. Most of the Hyrcan officers were drunk on their feet. Sergeant Gursk had stripped to his underwear and climbed the statue of the two-headed imperial eagle in the courtyard to string the Hyrcan colors from the crest. The streets were full of bellowing crowds, static, honking traffic, and wild firecrackers. Folion. Definitely Folion. Cadet Gaunt had smiled. Laughed, probably. But Octar had a way of being right all the time. And he had been right about this. The instrumentality of the Gilatus world flock had been delivered from the savage orc threat after 10 months of sustained killing on the Gilatan moons. Octar, Gaunt with him, had led the final assault on the orc war bunkers at Tropis Crater 9, punching through the last stand resistance of the brutal Huzkal retinue of war boss Elgoz. Octar had personally placed the spike of the Imperial Standard into the soft grey soil of the crater bottom, through Elgoz's exploded skull. Then here, in the Gilatan hive city capital on Decimus, the victory parades, the hosts of jubilant citizenry, the endless festivities, the medal ceremonies, the drinking, the poison. Canny, for orcs. As if realizing their untenable position, the orcs had tainted the food and drink reserves in the last few days of their occupation. Taster servitors had sniffed most of it out, but that one stray bottle. Adjutant Broff had found the rack of antique wines on the second night of the liberation festivities, hidden in a long box in the palace rooms, which Octar had commandeered as a playground for his officer Kader. No one had even thought. 8 were dead, including Broff, by the time anyone realized. Dead in seconds, collapsed in convulsive racks, frothing and gurgling. Octar had only just sipped from his glass when someone sounded the alarm. One sip. That, and Octar's iron constitution, kept him alive for 8 days. Gaunt had been off in the barracks behind the Hive Central Palace, settling a drunken brawl, when Tannhaus summoned him. Nothing could be done. By the 8th day, Octar was a skeletal husk of his old, robust self. The medics emerged from his chamber, shaking hopeless heads. The smell of decay and corruption was almost overpowering. Gaunt waited in the anteroom. Some of the men, some of the toughest Hyrcans he had come to know, were weeping openly.
"He wants the boy,"
one of the doctors said as he came out, trying not to retch. Gaunt entered the warm, sickly atmosphere of the chamber. Locked in a life-prolonging suspension field, surrounded by glowing fire lamps and burning bowls of incense, Octar was plainly minutes from death.
"Ibram."
The voice was like a whisper, a thing of no substance. "Smoke."
"Commissar General."
"It is past time for this. Well past time. I should never have left it to a finality like this. I've kept you waiting too long."
"Waiting?"
"Truth of it is, I couldn't bear to lose you. Not you, Ibram. Far too good a soldier to hand away to the ladder of promotion. Who are you?"
Gaunt shrugged. The stench was gagging his throat.
"Cadet Ibram Gaunt, sir."
"No. From now, you are Commissar Ibram Gaunt, appointed in the extremis of the field to the commissarial office, to watch over the Hyakin regiments. Fetch a clerk. We must record my authority in this matter. And your oath.
Oktar willed himself to live for 17 minutes more, as an administratum clerk was found and the proper oath ceremony observed. He died clutching Commissar Gaunt's hands in his bony, sweat-oiled claws. Ibram Gaunt was stunned. Empty. Something had been torn out of his insides, torn out and flung away. When he wandered out into the anteroom, he didn't even notice the soldiers saluting him. Part 3. Fortis Binary, Forge World. 1. It wasn't the drums that Korbeck really detested. It was the rhythm. There was no sense to it. Though the notes were a regular drum sound, the beats came sporadically like a fluctuating heart, overlapping and syncopated. The bombardment was still ever-present, but now, as they closed on the source of the beating, the drumming overrode even the roar of the explosions beyond the front trenches. Korbeck knew his men were spooked, even before Sergeant Corral said it. Down the channel ahead, Scout Sergeant McCull was returning towards them. He had missed the signal to put on his respirator, and his face was pinched, tinged with green. As soon as he saw the masked men of his company, he anxiously pulled on his own gas hood. "Report," Korbeck demanded quickly. "It opens up ahead," McCall said through his mask, breathing hard. "There are wide manufacturing areas ahead of us. We've broken right through their lines into the heart of this section of the industrial belt. I saw no one, but I heard the drums. It sounds like there are, well, thousands of them out there. They're bound to attack soon. But what are they waiting for?" Korbeck nodded and moved forward, ushering his men on behind him. They hugged the walls of the trench and assumed fire pattern formation, crouching low and aiming in a sweep above the head of the man in front. The trench opened out from its zigzag into a wide, stone-walled basin which overlooked a slope leading down into colossal factory sheds. The thump of the drums, the incessant and irregular beat, was now all-pervading. Korbeck waved two fire teams forward on either flank, Drail taking the right and Lucas taking the left. He led the front prong himself. The slope was steep and watery slick. By necessity, they became more concerned with keeping upright and descending than with raising their weapons defensively. The concourse around the sheds was open and empty. Feeling exposed, Korbeck beckoned his men on, the front prong of the attack spearheading out into a wide phalanx as men slipped down the slope and joined them. Drail's team was now established to his right, covering them. And soon Lucas's was also in position. The drums now throbbed so loudly they vibrated the hard plastic lenses in their respirator masks and thudded against their chest walls. Korbeck scurried across the open space with 8 men accompanying him and covering every quarter. Sergeant Grell moved another dozen in behind them as Korbeck reached the first of the sheds. He looked back and saw the men were keeping the line well, although he was concerned to see Drail lift his respirator for a moment to wipe his face with the back of his cuff. He knew the man was ill at ease following that unhappy injury, but he still disliked undisciplined activity.
"Get that fething mask in place,"
he shouted at Trooper Drail, and then, with 7 lasguns covering the angles, he entered the shed. The gabled building throbbed with the sound of drums. Korbeck could scarcely believe what he saw. Thousands of makeshift mechanisms had been set up in here, rotary engines and little spinning turbines, all in one way or another driving levers that beat drum skins onto cylinders of every shape and size, all stretched with skin. Korbeck didn't even want to think where that skin had come from. All that he was aware of was the syncopated and irregular thudding of the drum machines that the Shriven had left here. There was no pattern to their beat. Worse still, Korbeck was more afraid that there was a pattern, and he was too sane to understand it. A further sweep showed that the building was vacant, and scouting further, they realized all of the sheds were filled with the makeshift drum machines. 10,000 drums, 20,000, of every size and shape, beating away like malformed, failing hearts. Korbeck's men closed in around the sheds to hold them, and assumed close defensive file, but Korbeck knew they were all scared, and the rhythms throbbing through the air were more than most could stand. He called up Skulane, his heavy flamer stinking of oil and dripping petroleum. He pointed to the first of the sheds.
"Sergeant Grell will block you with a fire team," he told the flamethrower. "You don't have to watch your back. Just burn each of these hellholes in turn."
Skulane nodded and paused to tighten a gasket on his fire-blackened weapon. He moved forward into the first doorway as Grell ordered up a tight company of men to guard him. Skulane raised his flamer, his finger whitening under the tin guard of the rubberized trigger. There was a beat. A single beat. For one incredible moment, all of the eccentric rhythms of the mechanical drums struck as one. Skulane's head exploded. He dropped like a sack of vegetables onto the ground, the impact of his body and the spasm of his nervous system clenching the trigger on his flamer. The spike of fierce flame stabbed around in an unforgiving arc, burning first the portico of the blockhouse and then whipping back to incinerate three of the troopers guarding him. They shrieked and flailed as they were engulfed. Panic hit the men, and they spread out in scurrying, bewildered patterns. Korbeck howled a curse. Somehow, at the point of death, Skulane's finger had locked the trigger of the flamer, and the weapon, slack on its cable beneath his dead form, whipped back and forth like a fire-breathing serpent. Two more soldiers were caught in its breath. Three more. It scorched great conical scars across the muddy concrete of the concourse. Korbeck threw himself flat against the side wall of the shed as the flames ripped past him. His mind raced, and thoughts formed slower than actions. A grenade was in his hand, armed with a flick of his thumb. He leapt from cover and screamed to any who could hear him to get down, even as he flung the grenade at Skulane's corpse and the twisting flamer. The explosion was catastrophic, igniting the tanks on the back of the corpse. Fire, white hot, vomited up from the door of the shed and blew the front of the roof out. Sections of splintered stone collapsed down across the vestigial remains of Trooper Skulane. Korbeck, like many others, was knocked flat by the hot shockwave of the blast. Cowering in a ditch nearby, Scout Sergeant McColl had avoided the worst of the blast. He had noticed something that Korbeck had not, though with the continual beat of the drums, now irregular and unformed again, it was so difficult to concentrate. But he knew what he had seen. Skulane had been hit from behind by a las blast to the head. Cradling his own rifle, he scrambled around to try and detect the source of the attack. A sniper, he thought, one of the shriven guerrillas lurking in this disputed territory. All the men were on their bellies and covering their heads with their hands, all except Trooper Drail, who stood with his las gun held loosely and a smile on his face. "Drail!" McColl yelled, scrambling up from the trench. Drail turned to face him across the concourse with a milky nothingness in his eyes. He raised his gun and fired. 2. McColl threw himself flat, but the first shot seared down the length of his back and broke his belt. Slumping into the ditch, he felt dull pain from the bubbled flesh along his shoulder blade. There was no blood. Las fire cauterized whatever it hit. There was shouting and panic. More panic than before. Whooping in a strange and chilling tone, Drail turned and killed the two ghosts nearest to him with point-blank shots to the back of the head. As others scrambled to get out of his way, he turned his gun to full auto and blazed at them, killing five more, six, seven. Korbeck leapt to his feet, horrified at what he saw. He swung his las gun into his shoulder, took careful aim and shot Drail in the middle of the chest. Drail barked out a cough and flew backwards with his feet and hands pointing out, almost comically. There was a pause. Korbeck edged forward, as did McColl and most of the men, those that didn't stop to try and help those that Drail had blasted who were still alive. "For Feth's sake," Korbeck breathed as he walked forward towards the corpse of the dead guardsman. "What the hell is going on?" McColl didn't answer. He crossed the concourse in several fierce bounds and slammed into Korbeck to bring him crashing to the ground. Drail wasn't dead. Something insidious and appalling was blistering and seething inside the sack of his skin. He rose first from the hips and then to his feet. By the time he was standing, he was twice human size, his uniform and skin splitting to accommodate the twisting, enlarging skeletal structure that was transmuting within him. Korbeck didn't want to look. He didn't want to see the bony thing which was erupting from Drail's flesh. Watery blood and fluid spat from Drail as the chaos infection grew something within him, something that burst out and stepped free of the shredded carcass that it had once inhabited. Drail, or the thing that had once been Drail, faced them across the yard. It stood 4 meters high, a vast and grotesque skeletal form whose bones seemed as if they had been welded from tarnished sections of steel. The head was huge, topped by polished horns that twisted irregularly. Oil and blood and other unnameable fluids dripped from its structure. It looked like it was smiling. It turned its head from left to right, as if anticipating the carnage to come. Korbach saw that, despite the fact that all fabric and flesh of Drail had been shed away, the obscenity still wore his dog tags. The beast reached up with great metallic claws and screamed at the sky.
"Get into cover!"
Korbach screamed to his terrified men, and they fled into every shadow and crevice they could find. Korbach and McColl dropped into a culvert. The scout was shaking. Along the damp drainage channel, Korbach could see Trooper Melier, who carried the company's rocket launcher. The man was too terrified to move. Korbach slithered down to him through the fetid soup and tried to pull the rocket launcher from his shoulder. Melier was too limp and too scared to let it go easily.
"McColl, help me for Feth's sake!"
Korbach shouted as he wrestled with the weapon. It came free. He had it in his hands, the unruly weight of the heavy weapon unfamiliar to his shoulders. A quick check told him it was primed and armed. A shadow fell across him. The beast that was no longer Drail stood over him and hissed with glee through its blunt, equine teeth. Korbach fell on his back and tried to aim the rocket launcher, but it was wet and slippery in his hands, and he slid in the mud of the culvert. He began to mutter,
"Holy Emperor, deliver us from the darkness of the void. Guide my weapon in your service. Holy Emperor, deliver us from the darkness of the void."
He squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. Damp was choking the baffles of the firing mechanism. The thing reached down towards him and hooked him by the tunic with its metal fingers. Korbach was lifted up out of the channel, dangling at arm's length from the abomination. But the baffles were now clear. He squeezed the trigger mechanism again, and the blast took the beast's head off at point-blank range. The explosion somersaulted Korbach back 20 paces and dumped him on his back in a pile of mud and slag. The rocket launcher skittered clear. Headless, the obscenity teetered for a moment and then collapsed into the culvert. Sergeant Grell was right behind with a dozen men that he had roused out of their panic with oathing taunts. They stood around the lip of the culvert and fired their lasguns down at the twitching skeleton. In a few moments, the sculptural, metallic form of the beast was reduced to shrapnel and slag. Korbach looked on a moment longer, then flopped back and lay prostrate. Now he had seen everything. He couldn't quite get over the idea that it had been his fault all along. Drail had been contaminated by that fragment from the damned statuette. "Get a grip," he hissed to himself. "The men need you." His teeth chattered. Rebels, bandits, even the foul orcs he could manage. But this... The bombardment continued over and behind them. Close at hand, the drum machines continued to patter out their staccato message. For the first time since the fall of Tanith, weary beyond measure, Korbach felt tears in his eyes. 3. Evening fell. The shriven bombardment continued as the light faded, a roaring forest of flames and mud plumes 300 kilometers wide. Gaunt believed he understood the enemy tactic. It was a double-headed win-win maneuver. They had launched their offensive at dawn in the hope of breaking the Imperial front line, but expecting stiff opposition which Gaunt and his men had provided. Failing to break the line, the Shriven had then countered by falling back far further than necessary, enticing the Imperial Guard forward to occupy the Shriven front line and place themselves in range of the Shriven's artillery batteries in the hills. Lord Militant General Drevere had assured Gaunt and the other commanders that 3 weeks of carpet bombing from orbit by the Navy had pounded the enemy artillery positions into scrap metal, thus ensuring comparative safety for an infantry advance. True enough, the mobile field batteries used by the Shriven to harry the Imperial lines had taken a pasting, but they clearly had much longer-ranged fixed batteries higher in the hills, dug into bunker emplacements, impervious even to orbital bombardment. The weapons that were throwing the shells their way were Leviathans, and Gaunt was not surprised. This was a forge world, after all, and though insane with the doctrines of chaos, the Shriven were not stupid. They had been spawned among the engineers and artisans of Fortis Binary, trained and schooled by the tech priests of Mars. They could make all the weapons they wanted, and they had had months to prepare. So, here it was, a finely executed battlefield trap, drawing the Tanith First, the Vitrian Dragoons, and Emperor knew who else across no man's land into abandoned trench lines and fortifications where a creeping curtain of shellfire would slowly pull back, a meter at a time, and obliterate them all. Already the front line of the Shriven's old emplacements had been destroyed. Only hours before, Gaunt and his men had fought hand to hand down those trenches to get into the Shriven lines. Now, the futility of that fighting seemed bitter indeed. The ghosts with Gaunt and the company of Vitrian Dragoons with whom they had joined up were sheltering in some ruined manufactory spaces, a kilometer or so from the creeping barrage that was coming their way. They had no contact with any other Vitrian or Tanith unit. For all they knew, they were the only men to have made it this far. Certainly, there was no sign or hope of a supporting maneuver from the main Imperial positions. Gaunt had hoped the wretched Jantine patricians, or perhaps even some of Dravir's elite stormtroops, might have been sent in to flank them, but the bombardment had put pay to that possibility. The electromagnetic and radio interference of the huge bombardment was also cutting their comm lines. There was no possible contact with headquarters or their own frontline units, and even short-range Voxcast traffic was chopped and distorted. Colonel Zorin was urging his communications officer to try to patch an uplink to any listening ship in orbit in the hope that they might relay their location and plight. But the upper atmosphere of a world where war had raged for half a year was a thick blanket of petrochemical smog, ash, electrical anomalies, and worse. Nothing was getting through. The only sounds from the world around them were the concussive rumble of the shelling and the background rhythm of the incessant drums. Gaunt wandered through the dank shed where the men were holed up. They sat huddled in small groups, camo cloaks pulled around them against the chilly night air. Gaunt had forbidden the use of stoves or heaters in case the enemy rangefinders were watching with heat-sensitive eyes. As it was, the plasteel-reinforced concrete of the manufactory would mask the slight traces of their body heat. There were almost 100 more Vitrian Dragoons than there were ghosts, and they kept themselves pretty much to themselves, occupying the other end of the factory barn. Some slight interchange was taking place between the two regiments, where their troops were in closer proximity, but it was a stilted exchange of greetings and questions. The Vitrians were a well-drilled and austere unit, and Gaunt had heard much praise heaped upon their stoic demeanour and approach to war. He wondered himself if this clinical attitude, as clean and sharp-edged as the famous glass filament mesh armour they wore, might perhaps be lacking in the essential fire and soul that made a truly great fighting unit. With the shellfire falling ever closer, he doubted he would ever find out. Colonel Zorin gave up on his radio efforts and walked between his men to confront Gaunt. In the shadows of the shed, his dark-skinned face was hollow and resigned.
"What do we do, Commissar Colonel?"
he asked, deferring to Gaunt's braid.
"Do we sit here and wait for death to claim us like old men?"
Gaunt's breath fogged the air as he surveyed the gloomy shed. He shook his head.
"If we're to die," he said, "then let us die usefully at least. We have nearly 400 men between us, Colonel. Our direction has been chosen for us."
Zorin frowned, as if perplexed.
"How so?"
"To go back walks us into the bombardment. To go either left or right along the line of the fortification will take us no further from that curtain of death. There is only one way to go, deeper into their lines, forcing ourselves back to their new front line, and maybe doing whatever harm we can once we get there."
Zorin was silent for a moment, then a grin split his face. Even white teeth glinted in the darkness. Clearly, the idea appealed to him. It had a simple logic and an element of honourable glory that Gaunt had hoped would please the Vitrian mindset.
"When shall we begin to move?"
Zorin asked, buckling his mesh gauntlets back in place. "The Shriven's creeping bombardment will have obliterated this area in the next hour or so.
Any time before then would probably be smart. As soon as we can, in fact. Gaunt and Zorin exchanged nods and quickly went to rouse their officers and form the men up. In less than 10 minutes, the fighting unit was ready to move. The Tanith had all put fresh power clips into their lasguns, checked and replaced where necessary their focusing barrels, and adjusted their charge settings to half power as per Gaunt's instruction. The silver blades of the Tanith war knives attached to the bayonet lugs of their weapons were blackened with soil to stop them flashing. Camo cloaks were pulled in tight, and the ghosts divided into small units of around a dozen men, each containing at least one heavy weapons trooper. Gaunt observed the preparations of the Vitrians. They were drilled into larger fighting units of about 20 men each, and had fewer heavy weapons. Where heavy weapons appeared, they seemed to prefer the plasma gun. None of them had melter guns or flamers as far as Gaunt could see. The ghosts would take point, he decided. The Vitrians attached spike-bladed bayonets to their lasguns, ran a synchronized weapons check with almost choreographed grace, and adjusted the charge settings of their weapons to maximum. Then, again in unison, they altered a small control on the waistband of their armor. With a slight shimmer in the darkness, the finely meshed glass of their bodysuits flipped and closed, so that the interlocking teeth were no longer the shiny ablative surface, but showed instead the dark, matte reverse side. Gaunt was impressed. Their functional armor had an efficient stealth mode for movement after dark. The bombardment still shuddered and roared behind them, and it had become such a permanent feature they were almost oblivious to it. Gaunt conferred with Zorin as they both adjusted their microbead intercoms.
"Use Channel Kappa," said Gaunt. "With Channel Sigma in reserve, I'll take point with the ghosts. Don't lag too far behind."
Zorin nodded that he understood.
"I see you have instructed your men to set charge at maximum," Gaunt said as an afterthought.
"It is written in the Vitrian art of war. Make your first blow sure enough to kill, and there will be no need for a second."
Gaunt thought about this for a moment. Then he turned to lead the convoy off. 4. There were just two realities, the blackness of the foxhole below and the brilliant inferno of the bombardment above. Trooper Caffrin and the Vitrian cowered in the darkness and the mud at the bottom of the shell hole as the fury raged overhead, like a firestorm in the face of the sun.
"Sacred Feth, I don't think we'll be getting out of here alive,"
Caffrin said darkly. The Vitrian didn't cast him a glance.
"Life is a means towards death, and our own death may be welcomed as much as that of our foe."
Caffrin thought about this for a moment and shook his head, sadly.
"Who are you, a philosopher?"
The Vitrian trooper, Zogat, turned and looked at Caffrin disdainfully. He had the visor of his helmet pulled up, and Caffrin could see little warmth in his eyes.
"The Bayhata, the Vitrian art of war. It is our codex, the guiding philosophy of our warrior caste. I do not expect you to understand."
Caffrin shrugged. "I'm not stupid."
"Go on.
How is war an art?"
The Vitrian seemed unsure if he was being mocked, but the language they had in common, Low Gothic, was not the native tongue of either of them, and Caffrin's grasp of it was better than Zogat's. Culturally, their worlds could not have been more different.
"The Bayhata contains the practice and philosophy of warriorhood. All Vitrians study it and learn its principles, which then direct us in the arena of war. Its wisdom informs our tactics. Its strength reinforces our arms. Its clarity focuses our minds, and its honor determines our victory."
"It must be quite a book," Caffrin said, sardonically.
"It is,"
Zogad replied with a dismissive shrug.
"So, do you commit it to memory, or carry it with you?"
The Vitrian unbuttoned his flak armor tunic and showed Caffrin the top of a thin, grey pouch that was laced into its lining.
"It is carried over the heart, a work of 8 million characters transcribed and encoded onto monofilament paper."
Caffrin was almost impressed.
"Can I see it?" he asked.
Zogad shook his head and buttoned up his tunic again.
"The filament paper is gene-coded to the touch of the trooper it is issued to, so that no one else may open it. It is also written in Vitrian, which I am certain you cannot read. And even if you could, it is a capital offense for a non-Vitrian to gain access to the great text."
Kafran sat back. He was silent for a moment.
We Tanith. We've got nothing like that. No Grand